We've seen how the medical community of this country is the embodiment of all that is evil in this capitalist imperialistic system. The medical barons are dealing with us, the people, as if we were crops of livestock, as if we were cattle. That's right, we're livestock and cattle. The human ranch barons, the doctors, we carry their brands. From children, we carry vaccinations and medical things that they do to us without us knowing what they are. No one tells you that it's more dangerous to be vaccinated than not to be vaccinated. There's no smallpox in this country. They start on us young, and they work on us and build us up until we're nothing more than cattle to their machines. As Dr. Bronson said, we're meat. They look on us as specialized portions of meat. The doctor rancher barons have set up a class system to oppress the people, namely private medical care. What the hell is that? Private medical care means that the rich get medical care and we get fancy health systems that don't pay for a damn thing, don't pay for our drugs, don't pay for our follow-up visits, don't pay for home visits. They don't mean a damn thing. As Dr. Bronson says, we have to smash this system and build a collective system moved by the people. We get veterinary care. Amen. Okay. We as movement medical people are just beginning to relate to this. The fact that there's so few people out here shows us how ineffective we are. You have to realize that health is as important as anything else to building a movement. If you're sick, if you can't function, you're worthless on the street. You can't build a revolution with sick people. You've got to be well to fight. When movement doctors get together and to try to change things, when we came out on the streets in Chicago, at Columbia, San Francisco State, at Berkeley, and we're going to be on the streets again, at Stanford, we're going to be everywhere. What happens to us? We get thrown out of our licensure programs, we get oppressed by the medical societies, we get tossed underground, they take away our licenses. That's not going to stop us. We don't need licenses to serve people. We don't need licenses to train you to take care of yourselves. We don't need licenses to show you how your bodies work and how you can take over and run this health society. We need your support. We need you to help us. You have to help us take over this tyrannical health debt system. They'll put a man on the moon today, and they can't relate to the fact that poor white working babies, that black babies, brown babies, yellow babies are dying 5 times the rate greater than the urban rich kids. Technology has got to be taken out of the hands of the scientific magicians. It's got to be brought down to the people. You've got to understand how to deal with your own medical problems and how to determine your own medical destinies. You have to start as movement people focusing on health issues. They concern you directly. They're the only things that are really going to keep you alive. We have the power as doctors, as health people, you know, to make radical changes. And we need help, and we need you to go out in your communities and organize around health issues. We've seen this in the streets. I won't run down the beatings, the fact that all the medical people out there have been harassed, the nurses have been attacked in sexual terms. Please use their clubs to swat them on the asses. Make vague remarks, man, we'll fuck you with our clubs. You know, who needs that shit? Come down on them. Come around with us. Organize around health issues. When you're arrested, you're consistently denied medical care. There's no way that you can document your injuries. People bleed to death. People die of internal injuries in jail. In San Francisco this year, there were 30 deaths in the San Francisco City Jail, people that never got to saw a doctor. You've got to know the health laws in your state. In California, for every jail housing over 100 people, there has to be a doctor available 24 hours a day. They define what available is. Available to them means on telephone call out to the golf course or somewhere. You know, you've got to find out what those laws are and force them to put medical people where you're going to be. All of us know a little bit about preventive medicine. Just recently now, we're being able to get this across to the community. You've got to understand about lead poisoning, about garbage, about health issues, about sanitation, about food, over and over and over again. These are issues which we have to organize on if we're going to stay alive and healthy to fight this system. Chairman Bobby called this United Front for constructive action. We call it to organize around health issues. We prepared a pamphlet. We call it the Medical Cadre. It's colored of its red. Remember the red book? picture of Che Guevara, the revolutionary physician who left his medical bag and picked up his gun to fight alongside the people. That's where we belong. In your own communities, you have to recruit medical cadre. You have to organize around medical cadre. The pamphlet will save your life if you read it carefully. There's a first aid section in there that will deal with most of the things that you're likely to come in contact with street situations, the gas, the bullets, the clubs. You have to learn how to deal with this. Each of you must be able to take care of every other person in your collective. You have to know what diseases they have. You have to stock your houses with supplies. You can't risk going to a hospital. Sister Sharon told you how the hospitals call down the police. Man, you go out in an ambulance and they radio ahead. Any single injury, anything suspicious, especially if you're black. There's a squad of goons waiting for you at that hospital that interrogate you and beat you while you're lying there bleeding to death. They don't give a shit. You've got to organize. You've got to be able to take care of your own. You're being victimized. Your lives are being terrorized by organized medicine. You've got to form medical cadre. You've got to know how to take care of everyone in your collective. You've got to help us fight this war against fascism by organizing around collective issues. Thank you.
I'm in the studio with two people who have recently been in northern New Mexico. Dr. Richard Fine, who is co-chairman of the San Francisco Medical Committee for Human Rights, and Sherry Whitehead, who is very much involved in various collectives and in the International Liberation School. And both of you went to northern New Mexico, as I understand it, to have a look at both the need for medical services and some of the co-op work and ideas that are involved in life there now. Is that true?
That's correct.
A little less than, a little over a year ago, in August, which will be around that time, I spent several days in northern New Mexico and helped, as a matter of fact, with the distribution of the first copy of El Grito, which was then being published by Petita Martinez and Beverly Axelrod. And I see that you have come equipped with a number of copies of that paper, which I also received from northern New Mexico. I'm very eager to hear recent news of what's been going on there, because as I understand it, during the past year, great efforts have been made to do something about a very difficult medical situation and also to get involved in some producers' co-ops. So maybe you could give us some up-to-date data on both those situations.
Well, the producers' cooperative is in a much more advanced state than the medical cooperative, and which is one of the reasons that we went out to try to help establish some sort of guidelines for a medical cooperative in northern New Mexico. The producers' cooperative is now farming over 400 acres of land, of which 180 will produce this fall, and this food will then be marketed as a cooperative to the proceeds to return into the collective. They've purchased tractors and there's projects now for large buildings on this land, which is, you know, is reclaimed land from the Treaty of Hidalgo, and that's moving along very nicely.
Well, that's very good news. We've had previous reports at the time, of course, of the Tijerina trial, and we've had Reyes here at the microphone on a couple of occasions. And, of course, the land problem in northern New Mexico is the overriding problem, because these people feel, and doubtless with great justification, that the lands have been taken away from them and that they are now being crowded out by large blocks of privately held land, and that intrinsically their area is fertile and could support a decent economy of the people themselves. Is that...
That's true, but it's also a little more complicated than that, because at a national level, the Forest Service have been the chief enforcers and agents of the large capitalistic ranches that fence off thousands of acres of collective land that belongs to the people, and then permit the big Texas ranchers to graze their cattle in the national forest lands, and don't let the Hispano-Indian people use these lands. So it's in keeping with the country's policy of suppression of the Indians and third world people.
Yes, I believe there have been a number of villages literally wiped out by having their grazing lands, which from time immemorial they have used for their own animals, closed off. And Smokey the Bear, who is such a friendly character in the rest of the world, is not the most popular figure in northern New Mexico, I noticed.
Well, they burn his signs.
Well, that's at least apt, since he's all to do about fire. Well, but this cooperative now, it was started really by the people themselves, wasn't it, the producers' cooperative?
That's correct. I'd say 300 families in northern New Mexico, in the area around Tierra Amarilla, which is north of Española, where the movement newspaper El Grito is published, band together as a collective group of poor people, many of whom have original deeds to land. They've reclaimed this land, and they're planting and growing and working together. They have their own schools, and out of this obviously came the need for their own medical supplies, their own medical care, and their own medical system.
Has the government made any effort, or the Forestry Service, anybody, to displace them, or is this a particular area where they're functioning unquestionably, something theirs that nobody can do anything about?
It's primarily been local harassment, petty arrests, incredible traffic violations, people being arrested for drunken driving and convicted without blood alcohol tests or urine alcohol tests, the same kind of harassment that movement people feel here in the Bay Area, are felt at a much broader level in New Mexico. But there hasn't been an organized effort to drive them off their lands, except after the courthouse raid, when Tijerina made a citizen's arrest on the district attorney, which was his right to do so, was subsequently upheld in state court in New Mexico. And after this, the National Guard was mobilized, and a witch hunt for Alianza people was started, and there was at that point a concerted effort to drive the people off their lands. This did not succeed. The people fought back with every means they knew how. In one case, one of the local artists wrapped himself in dynamite and walked into the National Guard camp and lit the fuse and told them, to leave or they would all be blown up along with him, and they left. They haven't been back.
I suppose that that there's very widespread interest among the other Indian, Mexican-American people in that area of what's happening in this particular co-op, because if this could succeed, doubtless it would mean a great deal in terms of what might be done in other places. In other words, is it being treated and is it thought of among the people as a kind of pilot? Because nothing can happen in that kind of area without everyone knowing about it in 2 hours and 10 minutes, even if there is no news service.
I think that all the subcultures of northern New Mexico are looking with incredible hope towards the cooperative. Sure, many listeners are aware of the influx of what we call hippies or long hairs into northern New Mexico.
Freaks, they call them.
Right. The local word is freak. And if you're a hippie up there, you're a freak. And they call themselves freaks. And the Spanish people use the word freak to describe them. But they've also been incredibly oppressed, along with the Indians and the Chicano people. And the cooperative is an attempt to link all these cultures together by working together at the cooperative level. If the cooperative makes it, and I'm 100% sure it will because the spirit of the people is behind it, other cooperatives are going to spring up all over northern New Mexico to serve as models for the rest of the rural America.
Well, certainly one of the underlying principles of the Alianza and thing, people like Reyes's brother Chemo, who was working with the people, was to bridge the various cultures to the best of their ability, because one of the things which had been done there, as I understand it, which was very bad, was that the actual Indian culture, they had attempted to split off from the Chicano culture, from the Mexican-American culture, and the Alianza was making bridges to the actual Indian population that is left in northern New Mexico, what we've left of it.
One of the beautiful things that happened was when the governor of New Mexico turned on the Indians and tried to sell their sacred lakes and holy lands to the lumber industries, that the only group that supported the Indians was the Alianza and the cooperative, who sent delegates to the Indian Tribal Council and guaranteed that the Alianza and the cooperatives would fight for the Indian lands and work together with them. And recently, more of the community-minded freaks, the hippies, have joined in this alliance to help protect the Indian Holy Lands. And this, hopefully, is counteracting some of the incredible right-wing divide-and-conquer techniques that have been used to set minorities up there against each other. If you remember, the Minutemen, who were just arrested in New Mexico, were posed as hippies wearing beards and funny clothing. And we're sure that a lot of the atrocities that were perpetrated and blamed on hippies in northern New Mexico were really perpetrated by the Minutemen and people like them up in the mountains.
And also, I presume that I know, the legal hassle over the whole Hidalgo treaty situation still goes on, and I guess it's of indefinite duration, as most legal hassles are.
Especially since there are really no movement lawyers in northern New Mexico now that Beverly Axelrod has left. And that bogs things down incredibly.
Well, I understood that they were opening an ACLU office in Santa Fe. I don't know how useful that may be, but in any event, I read that. And have you any comments to offer on the area that we've been talking about so far, Sherry?
Well, one of the things that I tried to talk to people about when I came back from New Mexico was the feeling among the people there, among the majority of the population, that that they were in fact in an occupied territory, that they lived, that their identification was completely with the Latin American countries, the Latin-speaking countries, and that the white man had moved in there and occupied the territory, their culture, their language, and their entire way of living is that one with that of people in Latin America. You were talking about the organized effort to drive them out, and I think that the real effort, the real push, has come not through the courts or through the police, through the overt brute force of the state, but just through a concerted effort over the years of depriving people of their needs and of their culture and of an education, and giving them, just turning them around and setting the Mexican people and the Indian people against one another, and exploiting the differences between the hippies that would come in and this sort of thing.
Well, I spoke with a man who had lived there many years when I was there, who was an anthropologist, and one of the things that he objected to most strenuously was that when they do educate the Chicano or Indian children, they specifically educate them for trades and things of that sort, which they cannot get jobs in northern New Mexico. Mm-hmm. In other words, in order to use what skills they are taught, they must leave their own culture and their own homes and go into the cities, where, of course, they can be absorbed without notice, practically, in the economic, the sort of sub-economic processes of the big American cities, and he felt this was one of the most vicious aspects of the whole situation in northern New Mexico. He said they trained all the girls, for example, to be hairdressers. Well, you know, how many hairdressers do you need north of Santa Fe? And the boys to do various mechanical, simple mechanical things, which would turn them into semi-skilled, at least, labor, but not in northern New Mexico. And he had lived there at that time for many years and was, you know, had really made a study of it and knew what he was talking about. And I found this a very sort of subtle but extremely terrifying aspect of what was going on there.
It's even a little more far-reaching than that. The cities would hold out the promise of welfare in terms of food and housing and medical care to these people who were trained, you know, to do things that they couldn't function at, and they had to leave. There was nothing for them to do except live on the land, which had already been, you know, taken from them. And they came into the cities and were offered their food and their clothing and their medical care. And as of July 1st, New Mexico was one of the only states to do away with Medicaid, Medicare. And they have no medical care for these people in the cities, much less in the rural areas where there are no doctors. They promise them food and they give them powdered milk is the way they, you know, put it, the way the Chicanos put it. And what they want is their land to graze their own milk cows, not welfare's powdered milk.
Well, that certainly is obviously the next thing that we ought to discuss is what you found to be the medical conditions. I was told, again, when I was there, that they were really dreadful and that doctors, one village that they talked about in northern New Mexico where there had been one doctor in a very large area, and he had been drafted, put into the services, and that... I believe Chamel said the two things that were the worst was the fact that they had no medical, not enough doctors to go around on the level of childbirth and infections were the two things that he was most concerned about. Now, what was the result of your investigation, Dr. Fine?
Let me preface this by saying that I've traveled a lot, and I've traveled all through Africa and Middle East and Eastern Europe. And the medical conditions in northern New Mexico are worse than some of the worst slums I've seen in South America, than the abysmal poverty in Egypt and in the refugee camps in Palestine. In an area the size of the state of New Jersey, there's no doctor. Over one-third of the counties of the entire state of New Mexico have no doctor, and nor do they have a plan, you know, to implement any sort of, you know, health service for the people. The fledgling University of New Mexico Medical Center is forced to compete as a group practice for patients with private doctors in Albuquerque and can't even train doctors.
Now, what does that mean? I didn't get that.
That means that there's going to be no supply of doctors for the people unless the people...
Yes, but now this medical school, what happens to the students at the medical school?
The state can't support the hospital, and there's no... area, no real training hospital for students. As a result, few students come there, and the students who do come there are interested in getting a quick education and getting out of New Mexico because there's nothing for them to go into. There's no money, there's no program, and there's no plan. And one of the things that we tried to do was to set up an alternative plan in northern New Mexico to provide medical care and to provide service for the people in these areas where there are no doctors. And as Chamo Anselmo Tierina said, that the needs are those of simple needs, things that we take for granted. You know, you get a cut, you go someplace, somebody puts a bandage on it, stops the bleeding, and prevents infection by washing it. Well, this basic rudimentary knowledge is unknown. And people die literally by the hundreds from, you know, minor injuries, minor cuts, minor traffic accidents that no one knows how to deal with, you know, routine first aid. Infant mortality is something like 30 times that of urban Albuquerque in northern New Mexico, 30 times.
Well, what's the answer? I mean, if one could give an answer apart from just a feeling of intense humiliation that as people were responsible for this, would it be of any use to bring both to send people in who are in some way could be serving some kind of internship by being there is part of the answer, that some of these people should come out on grants to reputable medical schools and be able to go back to their people? How can it be solved?
That's a very complex question.
I think that the first obvious answer is that the problems won't really be solved until the people have taken control of their land and have established, or have liberated themselves from the kind of oppression that they're living under now.
Well, that's clear, that if all people could liberate themselves from all their oppressions, they would be able to do things. But in many areas of the world, we are trapped somewhere between that ideal situation and what we now have, and interim measures of some kind, even if all they do is demonstrate to people what could be done, are extremely useful. And you know, if there's some way to do something about it while the people's political consciousness and power grows, so that they can demand their rights and get them, then it seems to that it is worth doing.
Now, I see the situation in northern New Mexico really as no different than the situations in our urban ghettos and in you know, our entire country. And it's more polarized in northern New Mexico because the needs are so great and so easily identified. The needs in urban society, even among, you know, wealthy and middle-class people, are just as great. And that requires a healthcare revolution. And that's a lot of things that the younger doctors and people from the different groups that we've seen picketing the AMA and protesting and setting up our alternative plans are fighting for. And in New Mexico, we see this as a complete community-controlled health delivery system. I use the word health and not medical, because in this country we see disease as a commodity, and you know, doctors capitalize on people who are sick and really aren't interested in the health of the people, whereas at a cooperative level, the people are interested in their own health, and our nutrition and our diets and our way of living you know, all contributes to our disease process, and we can't view it out of social context. And in the social context in northern New Mexico, where there is a cooperative, where people are working together for their economic freedom, they'll begin working together for their health freedom.
The same people involved in the land cooperative will be working in the medical cooperative. And it's the same people who feel an identification with Reyes Tijerina as a political figure. And it's all part of the resistance movement that's developing there. The medical needs can't be isolated.
No, I'm sure they can't, but I nevertheless would be interested in
Let me tell you what we
an answer to the question that I asked earlier. What type of beginnings can be made, and how are people like you interested in going about making those beginnings?
Well, the first thing that we did was investigate the acute needs, and these were pretty well documented by the people. The people have know what their needs are by talking with them and talking with the health officials. We found out what the shortages were. It seemed that there's really a multi-pronged need. That's a bad choice of words. The needs have to be met at many levels. The first level will be an acute treatment service to prevent the needless death and the injury. And that requires a centralized clinic or office or hospital, depending upon how great the needs are. In northern New Mexico, it's going to require a huge hospital. Obviously, we can't start there, but we can start with a clinic, which can be staffed by community people. The community can care for their own clinic. They can maintain it. The money from the clinic that's brought in can be returned to the medical cooperative and be used for the other projects. Mobile vans, mobile ambulances, teams of trained sanitarians and public health workers to go out and teach people preventive medicine, which will in turn raise their level of medical consciousness and health consciousness, so there'll be less need for the acute centers. There is a plan now, you know, to purchase an acute clinic in northern New Mexico. The doctor that you mentioned earlier, who I'm not sure if he was drafted or volunteered, he was a very characteristic doctor of rural America. He also served for the police radio and used to walk around with a badge on. He was a deputy sheriff. And he would arrest his own patients for drunkenness or disorder. Again, being judge, jury, and physician, which is diametrically opposed to the needs of the people, and his job should have been to educate and to care for the people. However, there is a beautiful clinic which has been built in northern New Mexico in Tierra Amarilla. And the community, by pooling their lands, by taking mortgages out, have felt that it's important that they acquire this clinic.
Now, this clinic is presumably a private clinic, which would be available to them on a purchase basis, who built this clinic?
The clinic was built by this doctor who was there before, and by his missionary organization. In fact, all over the clinic, there are huge missionary plaques telling people that the way to be healthy is to not liberate yourself and free yourself, but to believe in certain of their spiritual doctrines.
But physically, it's a good clinic.
Physically, it's a fantastic clinic. More importantly, it's geared for expansion. It's also linked to the land. The clinic has 11 acres of irrigated farmland around it, which can be used as model farm or as a training ground for people who want to learn how to farm. And we really see the clinic not solely in medical terms, but in terms of the entire struggle that's going on in northern New Mexico to unite the people. We see the clinic as an area where the freaks or the hippies and the Indians and the Chicanos can work together for common goals. And to this end, the Indian Pueblo in Taos and a group of hippies in northern New Mexico have donated considerable sums of money and have mortgaged their land in order to provide sums to buy the clinic for the Chicano people in that area. The Chicano people, in turn, have promised to teach them more about farming. And, around a health issue then can grow the entire spirit of the revolution in northern New Mexico.
Well, is it far enough advanced so that they're really going to get this clinic, or is it something that's still in the balance?
The contracts have been signed. The mortgages have gone through. The initial acquisition of the clinic appears to be a reality. At this moment in time, there is no doctor to service, to live with the people and serve in the community. The community can support a doctor and a nurse, and desperately needs a doctor or a nurse. And one of the reasons that I went there was to try to find a way to present this incredibly revolutionary concept of a community-controlled clinic operated for the benefit of the people, with all the proceeds from the clinic going back into the medical cooperative, to the medical profession at large. We have other examples. Dr. Brooks's Salute Clinic is a good example where the profits from the clinic go into improving the clinic and improving the medical care in the community, and everybody takes the same small salary. This is the kind of thing that the cooperative envisions. Through the University of New Mexico Medical Center, we've been able to set up the role of the physician in this clinic will qualify for alternative service to the draft. If a physician does become a conscientious objector, and more physicians are moving in this direction, he can then serve the needs of his own people in northern New Mexico and fulfill his two-year draft obligation.
Well, that was the root of my original question, was how is the expertise, which they will in the opening stages at least need, going to be supplied? Could it be partly supplied from the outside world in terms of actual personnel, people who would be willing to devote, even if it was only a year or two, just as many graduates of law school for years went into the South and worked with the very few attorneys who were willing to handle civil rights cases, while those people found their own feet and their own, could draw on some kind of legal pool that they had more or less produced themselves. Now, you say you've got a tie-up of some kind with the medical school in New Mexico.
That's correct. And the medical school will help sponsor if the community in the initial stages is unable to support the physician. And by support, we're talking about $600 or $700 a month. It's pure subsistence. that they're willing to provide subsistence salary for the physician because they also feel the need for medicine to reach out into the communities. And having set up what we consider to be a model program for the way health delivery systems and health education should begin, they're willing to send consultants, and they're willing to send supplies, and they're willing to send their own people for short periods of time to northern New Mexico. There hasn't been a project for them to plug into until this project has opened, and it seems a beautiful way to institute some change in medical thinking. These people that are being trained in New Mexico will then go out, into the community, into their own communities, wherever they go, and take, this kind of vision and spirit with them to see the spirit of the people as they sit around and discuss their clinic, and their medical cooperative. It was a very moving, beautiful thing for me, especially when they could relate, to an Anglo such as myself, with open friendliness and complete warmth. It felt like a family, and it felt like I was a family doctor going into someone's house to, talk about family problem.
Has there been any obstruction on the part of the university itself or the administration to having such a tie-up between the university medical school and this sort of project?
I'm really not qualified to give you a full answer to this. There has been a lot of hassle. The people who have been trying to organize in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, to get a doctor to go up north, into northern New Mexico, have lost their jobs in the medical centers. The doctors have been threatened by the hospital administrators. Again, since so much of the medical school's functioning is dependent upon state and federal funds, and we've already seen how the federal government, through the National Forest Service, is in collusion to drive the people off their land and suppress them, the doctors are getting a little taste of what this oppression means to them. But they've been only more determined at that point to reach out to the people.
Well, how do you find that doctors outside this situation respond to this sort of idea? Has there been any response, or has it been presented to them in any form in which response could take place? I mean, one takes for granted that something like the Medical Committee for Human Rights would be interested in such a project and would cooperate in seeing to it that it was launched. But among the more conventional community of doctors, I would think that even many of them would be appalled at the conditions which you describe.
Well, I think that the harassment and oppression that Dr. Brooks got with his Salute Clinic in Visalia, when he was denied admitting privileges to hospitals, had his license threatened, shows that the conventional medical community will react with hostility, as well they should, because we're trying to change them, and we're trying to show them there's a new and a different and a better way to reach out to the people and provide them with medical needs, provide them with health education.
Yes, but on the other hand, there have been among younger people, for example, I remember at this microphone, and I can't specify exactly how long ago it was, quite a group of young medical students who had already signed some kind of document, and this had been rather widely spread over American campuses, in which they were refusing to, for example, go to Vietnam. So among the younger people in the medical profession, there must be some fertile soil for the kinds of attitudes and ideas that you're describing.
No, there are. I've had hundreds of letters, hundreds, from young physicians, saying, at the end of this year, I'll be able to do this. And medical students saying, I can spend my elective here. And within the year, we envision projects like this with teaching and training, as the paramount guide to preventive medicine, is springing up all over the country. And for this six-month interim is where we're trying to focus to find someone to meet the acute health needs of this particular community. And I have no doubt that this project, is just the beginning of a huge, major revolution in medical and health care throughout this country. And the needs, though, are for this interim period, this 6 months, when right now our theory has outstripped our practice, as is so often the case. And we need, someone, a physician, to relate to this community.
How about nurses? What about, wouldn't there be quite a great need for nurses who, in fact, have got the kind of training? I remember that in Delano, for example, one of the most hardworking people I've ever seen was was a woman who did not have a doctor's degree, but was a very highly trained nurse who worked with the, had some kind of, I think it was a trailer that she was originally set up in.
Actually, there is a public health nurse in northern New Mexico who has been, the doctor, friend, confidant of the people, and who has, worked herself practically to death meeting the needs. There are tremendous needs for nurses. There are tremendous needs for all levels of medical people, technicians, and these needs will be filled by the community. Again, this center that we're starting there, we envision to be a teaching center, and eventually to be a nursing and training school for technicians, and to bring the people, into their own community, and with community control, namely a community board that decides the issues that are going to be relevant to the health collective, this won't be a problem. But now I agree with you, we need nurses, we need anyone, who can function, at a technician's level, in northern New Mexico.
And gradually, if such a plan works, of course, out of their own ranks would come the people to be trained and the people to take the medical degrees and the nursing degrees. And I imagine that that's one of the relevant parts of this plan, is that while they may need some help from the outside at the moment, that this is a way in which they could become self-sufficient and operative at their own, in their own world, in their own way. Is there anything else that either of you would like to talk to us about in relation to your obviously exciting and creative trip to northern New Mexico?
Actually, I'm going back shortly. I can't stay away from there.
It's a wonderful place.
It's beautiful land.
It's the most beautiful place in some ways that it seems to me that I've ever seen. I've never been so impressed with the place.
They call it the land of enchantment, and it sounds kind of like a slogan, but it's really true. It's a beautiful place.
And the people seem to me to be very beautiful people.
Part of their whole culture is the way they feel completely at one with the land. In fact, one of the things that they believe in, along with La Causa, the revolution, is that they will have their land or they will die. It's that much a part of them, tierra o muerte.
You're going back.
Definitely. I eventually plan that when this system, begins to reach out to the people, we'll need more and more of us. As people take over their own destinies in economics, in health, in food, they'll have community controls, and pretty soon there'll be state controls, and then hopefully there'll be national cooperatives and national collectives where people will deal with things at the collective level. In the county, Rio Arriba County now, people almost control their own legislative destinies. They predict in the next 2 or 3 years they'll be able to have their own health commissioners and their own police force. The recent United Front Against Fascism conference here, the Black Panther Party and the National Liberation School dealt with the community control of the police. And in New Mexico, that's becoming a reality.
Well, it's one of the only places where such a situation exists, where in fact they have an unqualified majority. As that majority becomes self-conscious, that could be a great help, because in fact these people are not a minority in northern New Mexico.
But they've become a minority because they've allowed themselves, to be divided, with Indians turning against Freaks or Hippies and both turning against Chicanos. And again, we see the clinic and the cooperative as a way of bringing these people together. For a real quick example, I know we're running out of time.
We're never out of time on KPFA.
Okay, sorry. The geodesic domes that Buckminster Fuller has been talking about, really fit in conceptually with the way the Indian hogans used to be built and the way the adobe houses are made. And hippies who have learned to build geodesic domes are now going into the cooperative and building geodesic domes for the people using their adobe, and which I think is something that Buckminster Fuller really picked up on, but his idea has now been applied. And by the people going into the Chicano community and showing them something new and blending their culture, namely their adobe and their land, with their way of living, it's been able to create a bond between the two. And we find that as a very beautiful thing.
Yes, it sounds that way. And thank you, both of you, very much for coming in. And as the situation progresses, I hope you'll keep in touch. And I know that the audience will share with me an avid interest in the progress that you hope to make in northern New Mexico.